Phantom Doubleday Dell Audio Publishing presents Star Wars, Showdown at Centerpoint, Volume 3 of the Corellian Trilogy by Roger McBride Allen.
Solo, we are running out of time. We will be entering atmosphere soonest if our approach is not controlled.
Either the comm circuit up to the ship's control cabin was on the verge of giving out again, or else Han had just gotten lucky and Drachmas was about to lose her voice. Han slapped the answer switch and tried to stay focused on his work. Keep your shirt on, Drachmas. Tell honored pilot Sal Guldan I'm nearly done.
What shirt? Should shirts be worn? Is this for safety?
Han sighed and pushed the answer button again. It's an expression. It means be patient. Drachmas was a Solonian, and most Solonians did not like being in space. Understandable for a species that mostly lived underground, but having an agoraphobic who wasn't even a pilot in command of a rundown cone ship was enough to drive anyone crazy. Han Solo engaged the power switch, waited for the inverter system to energize, and crossed his fingers. He was starting to question his sanity in volunteering to help fly this particular cone ship down out of free space to the surface of Solonia. He could have said, so long and good luck, and ridden down with Leia on the Jade Spire. But when a job needed doing and no one else could do it, volunteering was not really all that voluntary. He had obligations to Drachmas and to her people. And Drachmas had made it clear that her people, the Solonians, or more accurately, the Hunchuzuk Den, couldn't afford to abandon any spacecraft, no matter what shape it was in. Knowing he was with the Hunchuzuk would have been a bit more useful if Han had had some clear idea about who or what the Hunchuzuk Den was. All he knew for sure was that the Den was part of an amorphous faction of Solonians who had left their planet in the Corellian system to live on his own home planet of Corellia. And that so far as Drachmas knew, they were still allied to a pro-New Republic alliance of Solonian dens called the Republicists. Drachmas had either kidnapped Han or rescued him from Thrakken Sal Solo, Han's cousin and the leader of the thugs who called themselves the Human League. Or both, Han was still not sure. The Hunchuzuk seemed to be having a fight with the Overden, the leadership on Solonia proper, a fight that was going on in parallel with the New Republic's battle against the rebellions in the Corellian system, though the two did not seem to be directly related to each other. The Overden wanted absolute independence for Solonia. Han was coming to the conclusion that each side was primarily against the other, but Drachmas had saved his life and she had taken risks to treat him well. Han knew that Thrakken Sal Solo had treated Drachmas' people with the utmost cruelty. Since relatives in Solonian society were genetically identical, Solonians were likely to assume that Han was a villain like his cousin. Yet Drachmas had given him every benefit of the doubt.
When will it be working? The planet is getting closer.
Don't hold me to this, but I think the spare parts off Mara's ship did the trick. We ought to be able to get underway anytime you like.
The indicators flickered to show the inverters were drawing more power.
Take it easy up there. Throttle up nice and slow, all right?
We are doing so, Honored Solo. We have no desire to overload our systems again.
Han climbed up to the nose cabin of the cone ship. The cone ship was just that, a fat cone with the engines at the base and the control cabin in the point. The nose itself was nearly all transplex, affording a spectacular overhead view. The Solonia pilot, Salcould, lay flat on her back, looking up and out at the sky ahead. She gave Han a toothy smile and returned her attention to her work, but the large, otter-like creature looked anything but calm.
How does all go?
Han asked Salcould, speaking in his rather labored Solonian. Salcould did not speak basic.
All is well, Han Solo. At least until the next subsystem flips out.
Wonderful, Han muttered.
Sal Gould was a fairly experienced pilot and knew her ship reasonably well, if not as well as Han would have preferred. Drachmas, on the other hand, was trained to deal with humans. When it came to ship handling, she had no experience and no skill. Even so, she commanded the ship, not just in deciding where it would go, but down to the detail of every maneuver. Sal Gould could not or would not overrule her. Drachmas was of higher status, and that was that. Neither seemed much concerned by the fact that Drachmas had only a slight understanding of space operations, or that during the battle between the New Republic and their allies against units from the various rebellions, she had repeatedly ordered the ship to do things it could not do, and had come alarmingly close to getting them all killed. The view out the transparent nose of the cone ship was nothing less than spectacular. The Salonian landmass was broken up into thousands of medium-sized islands, more or less evenly spaced across the face of the planet. But there was more to the view than the planet. Mara Jade's personal ship, the Jade Spire, hung in space a kilometer or two away, her bow hiding a bit of the planet's equatorial region. Mara's ship was long and streamlined, painted in a flame pattern of red and gold. The ship looked fast, sleek, strong, maneuverable, and Han knew she was all of those things. After Drachmas had given Salkul orders that had blown out nearly every system on board the cone ship, the fire had rescued them and provided Han with the spare parts he needed to repair the craft. Now the fire was preparing to see the cone ship to a safe landing. A bright light flashed on and off from the forward port of the fire. Leia was using the landing lights on the Jade's fire to send Mon Calamari blink code, combinations of long and short flashes to form the letters of the basic alphabet. Ready to begin entry, Han read. Signal when ready. Honor Drachmas, take your seat and prepare for acceleration. Sal Kulk, you will fly a standard approach to the intended field of landing, starting on my command. Is that understood?
Indeed, absolutely.
As Han watched, the Jade's fire came about on her long axis, putting her stern toward the cone ship. Sal Kuld edged the throttle upward, transferring minimum power to the engines. As the cone ship began to accelerate toward the planet, the fire drifted back. As the more maneuverable ship, it made sense for the fire to go in second, where she could keep watch on the cone ship. But the cone ship was all but completely blind astern. All she had was one wide-angle camera set in the base of the cone between two of the sublight engines. It would be useful during the final approach and landing, but even with the main engines off, its resolution was so poor that the Jade's fire would be lost to view if she drifted only a few kilometers away. The poor visibility made for another good reason to have the fire go in second. Better to have a ship you trusted at your back. At least a ship you more or less trusted. Han had managed to put to rest most of his reservations regarding Mara. He could think of no reason, no motive for her acting against Han and Leia and the Republic, despite her past as the Emperor's hand. But in recent days, she had been in the right places at the right times, and the wrong places at the wrong times, a bit too often. On the other hand, if she had wanted to do real damage, Mara was too much of a pro to let things be bungled. Say whatever else you might about the woman, Mara was competent. The planet moved closer. In another few minutes, Sal Kuld would have to turn the ship over and point its engines forward to slow the craft. That was the part that worried Han. Once they were decelerating, they would be at their most vulnerable. The cone ship's fragility was far from the only source of danger. Someone on Salonia had sent a whole fleet of light attack fighters up to attack the Bakuran ships that were assisting the New Republic on this mission. The Bakurans had done a fair amount of damage to the LAFs, but Han had to assume that whoever commanded them would have the sense to hold some in reserve. To make matters worse, the cone ship was completely unarmed and had no shields at all. Leia Organa Solo, chief of state of the New Republic, sat at the navigator station aboard the Jade's fire, watching a cone ship drift in toward Salonia. What exactly was Han getting them into? Leia was forced to think not just like a wife, but like a politician. There was no question that Han was being drawn in by these Salonians, and that she was being drawn in as well. It would be all too easy for the New Republic to find itself involved in one side or the other of the fight.
He'll be all right, Leia, Mara said. We'll stay right with them all the way down.
What?
Oh, yes,
Leia said. It was mortifying to be reassured by Mara Jade, of all people. Mara frowned and adjusted the thrust controls. Now that Salonian pilot needs a flying lesson or two. She's doing the pitchover maneuver way too early. And without shutting off her engines, nearly clipped her. Mara was forced to fly evasive patterns just to keep the fire from crashing into the other ship. Suddenly, she noticed something on her detector displays. Leia, weapons and shields, stand by, fast. A bunch of blips just showed up out of nowhere. Leia watched as the defense trackers came on. More light attack fighters. 12 in all, coming in right over our stern. Mara shook her head as she stared down at the navigation display. We can handle them, but it won't be easy now with the cone ship to cover. We're too far off to extend our shields toward the cone ship, and we're going to stay that way. I'm not getting any closer to that pilot than I have to. Stand by for combat maneuvers. Wait! We have to blink code to Han. Warn them. You've got 25 seconds. Han was almost too busy trying to keep from being flung out of his chair to notice the flashing lights in the overhead viewport. The trouble was that he was only marginally better at reading blink code than he was at sending it. B-A-N-D-I... Something Bandai? Bandits! Oh, great. Bandits. Enemy fighters were headed this way. Han glanced over at the Salonians. There was no point in telling Sal Gould about the bandits until she had the ship under control. Now then, Sal Gould, one other matter is time to, test our defense plan. You will bring the ship to spin, please, of 3 spins per minute.
Yes, commencing axial spin.
The ship began to rotate around its conical axis, so the stars pinwheeled across the sky. Han could barely spot the fire, and the bandits were almost certainly smaller coming from behind. There was no way he could find them, especially with the ship spinning like a top. No point worrying about things he could not change. Disable inertial damping, he said casually. The inertial dampers prevented anything more than a few percent of a ship's acceleration from being felt by those aboard. Without them, the occupants of a ship accelerating to light speed could be squashed to jelly.
But if we cannot restart inertial damping...
Sal Gould began. Worry about such later. Han knew better than Sal Gould what it might mean if they couldn't get the dampers back on, but they would have to live long enough for the problem to come up. Sal Gould inhaled nervously and cut off the inertial damping system. All of a sudden, Han felt his weight double, then triple.
Confirm all inner airlock sealed. All inner airlock doors sealed.
Han struggled to concentrate on the spinning star field overhead. If this was going to work, it would take exact timing. But how could he time anything if he couldn't see? Leia worked the shield settings on the Jade's fire. Shields configured as ordered, she said. Good, Mara replied. Maintain turbo lasers at standby. We are going to act like they aren't there. They might decide we can't see them. What good does that do us? They might blow right past us and zero in on the cone ship. My guess is that whoever's on those LAFs is targeting the Hunchuzuk, not us.
But Han is...
Safer this way, Mara kept watching her displays. If the LAFs don't engage us, we'll have nice, clear forward view shots right up their stern plates while they're focused on the cone ship. Leia gave in again. Mara had far more experience in this sort of fight than she did. Stand by. Here they come, Mara said. Leia watched the stern detector displays as the LAFs came in directly behind the fire's stern, trying to hide in the detection shadows produced by the sublight engines. They were trying to sneak up. From that bearing, they wouldn't even show up on most ships' detectors. The LAF flashed past the fire, zeroing in on the cone ship.
Here they come!
Han shouted in basic, forgetting for a moment to speak in Salonian. Sal Gould got the message all the same. She looked up through the viewport at the tiny spots of light in the sky and understood precisely what was going on.
Calmness!
Throttle down all engines. Stand by to open outer airlock doors. The lead LAF fired and the bolt slammed into the hull like a giant fist.
It's all right!
Han shouted, having not the least idea if it was or not.
Stand by on airlock doors. Be ready.
The Jade's fire's forward quad turbo laser blazed away, tracking the LAF across the sky. The LAF broke off its attack run, trying to escape, but the Jade's fire regained a positive lock and poured on the turbo lasers. The fighter exploded in a blossom of flame. The rest of the LAFs were not going to be such easy pickings. They had their rear shields powered up to maximum and did a better job of evasive maneuvers. But it wasn't good enough to fool Leia. She settled in with the manual controls and concentrated her fire on the LAFs closest to the cone ship. She got a lock on one and blew it to bits. Just then, the cone ship cut its engines, allowing it to drop straight for the planet's surface. It threw the LAFs off, if only for a moment or two. Leia sighed. Not much of an evasive maneuver, but probably the best Han could manage with that clunky piece of junk. But suddenly, her detector display showed a cloud of debris blooming out from the cone ship in all directions. Fear stabbed at her heart. That one hit on the hull couldn't have done that much damage, could it? But then something happened to one of the LAFs. And then another. And another. As they swooped in close to the cone ship, they bounced and skittered and wobbled off course. Two of them lost power, and the third was rocked by a small explosion amidships. Leia tried to track to a new target, but the LAFs had plainly decided to accept the fact they weren't welcome. They scattered, hightailing out of there in all directions. Suddenly, Leia understood. Mara, new course, 5 or 6 kilometers to one side of Han, and try to overtake him. It's not going to be safe to be behind him for a while. Leia smiled, relief flooding over her. She should have known Han wouldn't give up without a fight. Han listened closely as the last of the junk went lumbering out of the airlocks, banging and clattering. He had spent half a day policing the ship, looking for every bit of surplus or broken hardware he could find. Buckets of bolts, worn-out spare parts, garbage from the galley. He had thrown all of it into the locks. And all of it had tumbled out into space when the locks were opened, thrown clear by centrifugal force. Result, a cloud of slow-moving space junk right in the path of the attacking LAFs. Plowing through pieces of broken metal at a speed of something like 1,000 kilometers an hour was very far from a good idea. However, piling a ship into a planet was an even worse one. Salkult, reestablish inertial dampers and cut ship spin. The ship's ungainly spin slowed, then stopped, and then started up again in the opposite direction and started to get faster. Salkult, this is no time for the playing of games. Han Solo, failure in lateral attitude control system. I cannot shut it off. Han scrambled up out of his seat and dove for the main circuit breaker box. He yanked it open and tripped the lateral attitude control breaker by hand. That killed the thrusters that were producing the spin, but also killed the ones that fired in the opposite direction and could bring it to a halt. He slapped the access door shut and returned to his seat. Hope everyone is liking to spin for a while. Salkult, restart to main sublight engines. And nice, slow throttle up, please. Nothing seemed to happen. Not that slow, Salkult. We need to do some braking. Salkult looked at Han, panicked.
Engine initiator, not responding. Horror,
cried Drachmus.
We incinerate for certain.
Once again, Han rushed for the ladder and clambered down to the lower decks as fast as he could. Without the sublight engines, the cone ship was going to drop like a stone. They had to restart those engines.
Out!
Han shouted at Salkult as he came up out of the hatch. Out of pilot chair, now! I take over.
But what are you...
I've taken the disperser out of the loop and run the cables through the initiator power intake on the engine power system. The feedback energy is accumulating in the repulsor system. When the power level is high enough, I'll reset the feedback power breaker and dump the energy right into the initiator intake on the engine power systems.
What?
Jump start it! I'm gonna jump start it! There was a moment of dead silence in the control cabin before Drachmus let out a strangled moan and covered her face with her hands. For a fleeting moment, Han thought of Leia, watching from the jade fire and unable to do anything. He thought of his 3 children off somewhere in the care of Chewbacca and the children's Drawl tutor, Ibrahim. No, he could not die. They needed him. Han waited as long as he dared, then one moment longer, then one more, and then... He slammed down the relay reset switch as hard as he could and felt a horrifying lurch just as a low, rumbling explosion shook the ship. That would be the repulsors blowing. For a long, sickening moment, nothing else happened. But then the engine's initiated indicator came on and Han had 3 good engines. Even if that was 1 less than he had hoped for, it was 3 more than he had expected. Ignoring all his own advice, he brought the throttle up fast. There wasn't time to nurse the engines. The cone ship slowly pitched back until it was flying at about a 45-degree angle of attack. It was still falling straight down, but now its nose was pointed an eighth of a turn away from the vertical. If Han had it figured right, that ought to give the cone ship a bit of aerodynamic lift, causing it to work like an airfoil. The ship began to move sideways as well as down. It began to bang and shudder violently, but every crash and rattle was that much more excess energy expended.
I'm Han Solo,
Dokmus protested above the racket.
Where are you taking us?
I haven't the faintest idea, but we have to go lateral to shed some speed.
But suppose we land outside the zone controlled by my den?
Then we have a problem. Dokmus did not reply to that, but she had a point. Landing completely at random on a planet in the midst of civil war was not exactly prudent. Han pushed it from his mind. The job of the moment was getting this thing down in one piece, down where they could sort out later. He checked his gauges. They were still falling like a rock, but a slower rock, a gliding rock. And hull temperatures were actually falling. Maybe they were going to make it. Han cut power to all systems and diverted it all into the inertial dampers. There was no way the dampers could absorb all the energy of impact, but they would soak up some of it. He had not the faintest idea where they were about to land. 1 kilometer up, 800 meters. How accurate was that altimeter anyway? 200, 150, zero. Negative 10 meters. Well, not all that accurate. But every extra meter was another fraction of a second for the cone ship's engines to slow them down. Neg 20. Neg 50. The overhead viewport held together somehow. And Han could see the sky was filled with smoke and steam and mud. Huge gobs of sodden dirt splattered down on the viewport, covering it all but completely. Except for Drachmas moaning in fright and the plopping sounds of mud raining down on the ship's hull, all was quiet. They were down and alive. The cone ship had buried itself into the soft mud of a pond. Han sat on the edge of the hatch and hopped down, only to sink in over his ankles in the thick mud. He lifted his left foot up out of the muck, nearly losing a boot in the process, and planted it as far away from the ship as possible before pulling his right foot out. He squelched out of the pond basin toward dry land and saw a Solonian, an older-looking female with graying dark brown fur and a moody look in her eye.
That's a Hansa cone ship, be it not?
The Solonian asked, watching Drachmas and Salkuld stagger out of the craft.
That's right, Han said as he slogged through the mud.
That was the Solonians for you. A spaceship crash lands in a pond in front of someone, and what's the response? Not shock, or surprise, or fear. Not hello, or what an amazing escape. Not are you all right?
No.
The first thing to worry about was what den was involved.
Huh,
said the Solonian.
This is Chanzari land. We be republicists, Hunchazuk allies.
The Bakurin light cruiser Intruder fired her main forward turbo laser battery 3 times, and 3 pocket patrol boats exploded.
Very well, said Admiral Hortel Osinich. You may hold your fire. Bring the turbo lasers to their stowed position and power them down. Make sure our friends can detect what you're doing. We have shown we can hurt them at will. Now we extend an invitation to leave.
Luke Skywalker stood next to Admiral Osinich on the bridge of the Intruder. A reasonable tactic, Luke thought. As always, when he agreed with the man, he did not feel comfortable doing so. He glanced at Lando Calrissian standing on the other side of Osselage, and the look on his face told him that Lando shared his concerns. The tactics were sound, even conservative. The enemy forces consisted of little more than 20 or so pocket patrol boats. There was nothing much to be gained in wiping out such a small force. Very sensible and cautious. Except that Osselage was not a cautious commander. If it seemed he was trying something careful, Luke had a hunch that it was merely a cover for something madly audacious to follow. Or had losing the one of his 4 cruisers, the Watchkeeper, to the Solonian planetary repulsor, cost Osselage his nerve? Of course, with the overwhelming bulk of Centerpoint Station dominating the sky outside the viewport, Luke would have felt a little edgy even if the Watchkeeper hadn't been destroyed.
There they go,
Lando announced, pointing toward a cloud of tiny dots lifting away from one of the docking bays of Centerpoint. The defending fighters were withdrawing.
Decided they couldn't do any good against us, I guess. Or perhaps they decided we would be unable to do Centerpoint any harm,
said Ocelich. A service droid wheeled up from behind them and stopped in front of Lando.
Begging your pardon, sir, but Lieutenant Kalinda wishes to see both you and Master Skywalker, sir. A new message from Source T has come in.
Source T was Tendra Rezaunt. Lando and Luke had met Tendra on Sikoria, one of the so-called outlier worlds of the Corellian sector. The local authorities had kicked Lando and Luke off Sikoria shortly after they arrived. Lando had met Tendra while searching the galaxy for a rich wife. From what Lando could piece together, she had spotted some sort of military buildup in the Sikorian system. Recently, a powerful jamming system had cut off virtually all communications in the Corellian sector. Then an interdiction field had gone up, preventing travel through hyperspace anywhere in the sector. Believing these events related to the buildup, Tendra had decided to get word to Lando. She had gotten her hands on an old spaceship, bribed her way off Sikoria, and crashed into the interdiction field. Even though she couldn't get to Lando in person, he had made it possible for her to contact him. The signals from the radionics communications set he had given her were immune to jamming and undetectable to anyone using standard comlink equipment. It took long hours for her messages to reach him, but it could take long, weary months before her ship could cross the same distance. Unless, of course, they could bring down the interdiction field, and that was why they were heading toward Centerpoint Station, where the jamming seemed to originate. The security system beeped its clearance code, and the hatch to the comm section slid open. Lieutenant Belindi Kalenda of New Republic Intelligence was waiting for them. An odd-looking young woman. Right now, her wide-spaced, slightly off-kilter eyes did not look happy. "Didn't anyone ever tell your lady friend how to count?" she said. "We still have no idea how many ships are waiting out there at Sikoria."
"We wouldn't have known there were any ships at all there if not for Lady Tendra,"
Lando said sharply.
"Let's try and get back on track here," Luke said.
"What's wrong with Lady Tendra's message?"
"We have sent 3 queries asking her to give further details of the types, sizes, and numbers of ships she saw. Her latest message seems more precise, but once you weed out all the qualifiers, we still have nothing but the vaguest estimates."
"Well, she can't tell you what she doesn't know," Lando said.
"There are also limits to how many messages you can ask her to send," Luke put in. "Every time she sends us one, the odds of her being detected go up." Kalinda looked at Luke sharply.
"Detected? How?"
"Think about it," Lando said. "You're the intelligence officer. The way she's broadcasting is secret, but it's in clear without any coding or encryption. Anyone who has the right sort of gear for scanning radio band frequencies could lock in on her radionics transmission in a heartbeat."
Kalinda nodded reluctantly.
"Let's leave it there," Lando said. "We're coming up on Centerpoint Station. Figuring that out ought to be enough to keep us busy."
The Lady Luck launched out of the intruder's landing bay and lifted off into the blackness of the sky toward Centerpoint. Lieutenant Kalinda and Bakuran ex-Prime Minister Gariel Kaptison rode with Lando, as did C-3PO.
"Why do I always get handed these jobs?"
Lando asked no one in particular.
"Maybe it has something to do with the way you volunteered," replied Gariel Kaptison from the seat behind the co-pilot station.
"I had to volunteer. Once Luke volunteered, I knew he was going to need his wingman."
"Actually, Lady Kaptison," said Kalinda, "you're the one I most wish weren't here."
"Thanks for that compliment,"
Lando muttered.
Kalinda winced.
"Sorry, that came out wrong. What I meant was that Captain Calrissian and Master Skywalker have military training. They're more likely to be ready for whatever we find. Not really the job for an ex-Prime Minister."
"There might be someone reasonable with whom we can negotiate on Centerpoint Station. If so, having a trained negotiator such as myself on hand might be a good thing," said Gariel.
"We're going to have to get really lucky for that to happen," Lando said. "So far, we haven't found many people who are particularly reasonable in this star system."
Luke Skywalker felt good. He was back at the controls of his X-Wing, alone, except for R2-D2 up in his socket. He looked toward the massive station and could scarcely believe his eyes. He had seen the reports, he had read the numbers, but somehow, numbers did not express the size of the object hanging in the sky. Center Point Station consisted of a huge sphere, 100 kilometers across, with a massive cylinder stuck to each pole of the sphere. The station rotated slowly around the axis defined by the two polar systems. Boxy things, the size of large buildings, pipes and tubes of all sizes, and strange patterns of conical shapes sprouted everywhere. Luke had been on worlds smaller than this station. Apart from the question of size, the station was disconcerting because it spun. Spinning was something that planets did, but you could see center point moving. Something else, more fundamental than size or spin, was bothering Luke. The station was so old that no one knew how long ago it had been built, or who had built it, or why.
Luke, if you're there.
I'm here, Lando, but your signal is breaking up badly. With normal communications still jammed, the Bakurans had done their best to improvise a laser comm system that sent voice signals over low-power laser beams. It did not work well, but it did work. R2, see if you can clean that up a little. Luke nodded. Okay, Lando, try it again. How do you read me?
Much better. Yolanda spotted something. Look at the base of the closest cylinder. Right where it joins the sphere, there's a blinking light. Here, see it?
Luke activated the targeting computer to get a lock on the blinking light. There it was, next to a large outer airlock door that was opening and shutting over and over again. If that's not an invitation to come on in, I don't know what is. Anakin Solo stared at the featureless silver wall, and then thumped twice at one particular spot on it. Sure enough, an access door popped open, revealing a purple and green control keypad with a grid of keys. The 7-year-old frowned at the keypad, as if trying to decide his next move. The droid Q9X2 watched carefully. Q9 found Anakin's skill with machinery, his seemingly instinctive ability to make devices work, even when he had no idea what the devices were, to be remarkably disconcerting. It seemed to have something to do with this force business that was so important to this group of humans. The theory seemed to be that Anakin's talent in the force had given him the ability to see inside machines. Not that the little boy was infallible by any means. Anakin punched a code into the access panel. Experience had taught Q9 that this sound was not a good sign. It seemed to be a sort of warning bell.
That will do, Anakin.
But I've almost got it working.
Do you have any idea what it does?
No,
Anakin admitted.
Do you remember what happened the last time you heard that chime and you kept going?
A trap door opened.
Yes, a trap door opened under me, and I fell into a waste disposal chute.
Oh, maybe I better stop and let Chewie look.
Maybe you'd better. Come on. Let's go find the others.
They were a motley crew, all of them holed up inside the underground repulsor chamber on the planet Drawl. The place was shielded from every detection system that Q9 knew about, with the exception of Anakin Solo. Anakin had found this chamber and its identical twin on Corellia with no trouble whatsoever. And there were good reasons for hiding the chamber. It contained the planetary repulsor that had propelled Drawl into its current orbit unknown millennia ago. Likewise with Corellia, and no doubt with the other inhabited worlds of the Corellian sector, Celonia and the double worlds Talus and Trollus. Each of them had a hidden chamber like this one. The party in the repulsor chamber had been cut off from outside contact for some time, but the last information they had was that rebel forces on at least some and probably all of the inhabited worlds were actively searching for the repulsors, possibly so they could use them as weapons.
The chamber itself was a huge vertical cone made of gleaming metallic silver. At the base of the chamber was a circle of six smaller cones of the same silver material. In the exact center of the base was a seventh, larger cone, twice as tall as the others, but with the same slender proportions. Passages to side chambers were spaced around the circumference of the chamber, and vertical shafts in the floor led to a series of lower levels they hadn't even started to explore. It was a huge, artificial, alien place. And a ramshackle, homey-looking campsite was sitting right in the middle of it, by the base of the central cone. The Millennium Falcon was also in the chamber, the hover car belonging to the Solo children's Drolin tutor Ebrahim, and his aunt, the Duchess Marcia of Mastagotharis, was parked alongside it. A line with washing on it was strung between the Falcon's topside parabolic antenna and a spike antenna on the roof of the hover car. Q-9 could see the rest of the party from here. The twins, Jason and Jaina, carrying some sort of gear out of the Millennium Falcon, Chewbacca fiddling with hardware, and the two plump, furry drawl at a table hunched over their own work. The drawl were serious, level-headed beings in general. Even if Ebrahim was a bit flighty by drawlish standards, his aunt was one of the most commonsensical beings Q-9 had ever met. No doubt Anakin's latest discovery would give them something else to work on, another piece to the puzzle they were struggling to put together. It was well into the night before Ebrahim finally said to the Duchess,
"Come, dearest aunt, it is late.
Everyone else is asleep.
Whatever progress we have made is only the barest start toward understanding this place,"
the Duchess replied.
"We have some idea of how the key pads are laid out and what some of the button markings and color codings seem to mean. But going from there to operating this place and shutting it down safely, a machine that has been operating for at least tens of thousands of years, we have no idea how it draws its power. Suppose we do learn how to turn it off. Where does the power go once it is not coming here? I think it most probable that this chamber is but one part of a much larger system. We are dealing with a device that can move a planet. Used improperly, a device of that power could also destroy a planet. I do not see any way of learning all we need to know in any reasonable period of time.
Unless, of course, we simply instruct Anakin to find the main control panel and then set him loose on it."
March's eyes widened in horror.
"Do not say such a thing, nephew. Not even in jest. Jokes like that have a way of coming true."
Anakin's eyes snapped open. He was wide awake and staring up at the underhull of the Millennium Falcon. He sat up quietly and looked around. Everyone was asleep. That left Q-9. Anakin knew that the bulk of the Falcon would block nearly all of the droid's sensors. So long as he kept the ship between himself and Q-9, he ought to be able to sneak away. He moved unerringly through the complicated maze of passages, taking every turn with absolute confidence. And there it was, just as he had left it, the initial keypad open and waiting. He closed his eyes, reached out, and felt the interior of the pad, tracing the circuits, the logic paths, the potentials and safeties that were inside the machine. It had been asleep for so long, waiting for someone to wake it up. Anakin pressed the center button of the grid. The green button turned purple. Good. Slowly he felt each button, pushed them in what he knew was the right order. A section of the floor was sliding away. Then a complicated console rose slowly up out of the floor, all in the same silver stuff as the chamber itself. In front of it was a little seat that looked as if it were intended for a being that bent in different places than a human. Hopping with excitement, Anakin sat down in the odd little chair and did not even notice that it was adapting itself to his body, lifting him up and moving him forward so he would be able to reach the controls more comfortably. He shut his eyes and reached out into the intricate universe of the control panel. Anakin put his hands on the control panel and felt it all flow through him.
somewhere deep below, the ground shuddered slightly. And the hum began to build, accompanied by the noise he'd heard before. A flat spot on the control panel swirled upward to form a handle like a spacecraft's joystick. Anakin reached out to it as the handle reshaped itself to fit his hand. A graphic display appeared in the air over the handle, a hollow wireframe cube made up of a grid of smaller cubes. Slowly, carefully, he pulled back on the joystick. The cubes began changing color, green to purple to glowing orange. Anakin let go of the joystick. The moment he did, the chiming stopped. The joystick flattened itself back down into the control panel. And there, in the blank space at the center of the panel, a new button appeared. He held his hand poised over the button for a moment. It called to him, or else his own compulsion to make machines work called from deep inside himself. He did not know. He did not care. He reached out his left hand. He held it over the button for a moment. And then he pushed it down. Lightning flared out from the apex of the central cone in the great chamber, lancing out toward each of the lower cones, slamming into them with spark and fire. Thunder, the sound of the earth cracking open, roared out through the great chamber. The lesser cones answered back, sending their own thunderbolts to strike at the top of the center cone, blasting it into incandescence. Chewbacca, aboard the Falcon, was thrown from his bunk as the ship bounced and lurched along with the chamber. He was halfway to the ship's control room before he came fully awake and realized that the ship was not in flight, but where it had been on the ground. He rushed down the ramp and shouted at the Drolls, sleeping in the hover car, to get aboard the Falcon. He saw Q-9 slump next to his charging stand, completely motionless. He scooped the droid up and headed for the Falcon. At that moment, the lightning struck again, blasting out from the central cone to the six smaller cones. The Falcon bounced on its landing jacks, riding their shock absorbers. The two Drow, the droid, the twins were all on board. Chewbacca suddenly realized that Anakin wasn't on the ship. He turned and headed toward the door. "Anakin's safe!" Jason shouted over the din, clearly seeing Chewbacca's concern. "He's in some side tunnel. I can feel him through the force. He's not hurt, and he's more scared we'll be mad at him than scared he'll get hurt. I think he set this off." Chewbacca rushed for the cockpit and activated the Falcon's shields at full strength. The Falcon rose up off her landing jacks to rest on a cushion of softened lower side shields. The bucking and heaving of the deck was still felt, but the shields smoothed it down. Another spectacular cycle of lightning bursts flashed between the cones, and then another, and another, each growing faster and more powerful. Suddenly, the entire ship was bathed in a firestorm of sparks and flares that coursed around the shields, then swooped up the sides of the conical wall toward the apex of the chamber. Chewbacca began to realize what was happening. The chamber of the planetary repulsor was opening out its apex point to get a clear shot of the sky. There had been a whole series of underground tunnels leading to the hidden entrance to this place. Surely, all of them had collapsed. Along with the Drawlist building that sat atop them, the Drawlists had been searching for the planetary repulsor. By now, the planetary repulsor had found and destroyed them. Jason came into the cockpit.
"They're all okay back there," he said. "Except Q-9. He's still dead. Or off, anyway."
Chewbacca nodded. They were lucky any of them were alive. If Q-9 could be repaired, he would attend to it later. If not, well, one casualty seemed a very low price for riding out this storm.
Another pulse of energy swept over the Falcon. A bit rougher rise than the last one.
That was a reminder, Chewie thought. A reminder that they weren't close enough to the end of this to talk about living through it. Thrakken Sal Solo, self-proclaimed diktat of the Corellian sector, leader of the Human League, stared at the bottle in front of him and gave serious thought to the idea of getting good and drunk. There seemed precious little else he could do besides wait. Thrakken had never been much good at waiting, which was ironic, for he had spent much of his adult life waiting for a superior to resign or retire or be arrested, waiting for a plot to mature, waiting for the long-awaited offer of succession from Dupas Tomri, diktat of Corellia. Waiting until the day Tomri died, waiting for sweet victories that had melted away into bitter, humiliating defeat. Thrakken grabbed the bottle by the neck and went out into the corridor of the archaeological dig headquarters. He would have preferred to keep his headquarters in the underground bunker on the far side of the city, but the Human League had been forced to abandon that location. The blasted Salonians had yanked their compatriot Drachmas out of there, along with Thrakken's traitor cousin, Han Solo. It hadn't taken much imagination to realize that a group that could take two prisoners out of an underground bunker could just as easily put one bomb in. Call it another debt on the account Thrakken was drawing up against Han Solo. Outside, Thrakken watched the second shift men coming on duty, headed for their work underground. They were still searching for the Corellian planetary repulsor. It had to be hidden in the tunnel somewhere beneath them. It had to be, or things were going to get very sticky indeed. Except things were already sticky. Solo had escaped. Leia Organa Solo had escaped. The Bakurans had busted through the interdiction field somehow. Thrakken knew just how dangerous a game he was playing. He had claimed to control the Starbuster plot, the power that had already exploded two star systems, one of them populated. For the moment, at least, it suited the purposes of the Starbuster's real masters to let him go on claiming it. They believed Thrakken would keep to his side of the bargain and back off his claim when the moment came for them to reveal themselves. They also believed that Thrakken would turn over the planetary repulsor on this world as soon as he found it in return for getting a free hand on Corellia. Thrakken had other plans. The masters of the Starbuster had told all the rebel leaders that the planetary repulsors were superb defensive weapons, nothing more. Thrakken knew better.